Welcome to the Someone Somewhere podcast. It's Thursday, April 25th, and I'm your host, Nicole. This is episode 61. This episode is brought to you by hashtag FamTaughtMe, my fertility awareness education initiative. You can find all of my fertility awareness information on my website, www.learnbodyliteracy.com, or follow me on Twitter and Instagram at LearnBodyLit to learn more. This episode will explore the question of what constitutes a vulva. A couple things might come to mind. Some people will think, wait, isn't the vulva and the vagina the same thing? Other folks, maybe some who are more familiar with this podcast, may simply say, well, the vulva is the external part and the vagina is the internal parts, and that's the obvious difference. But the question of what makes a vulva is still somewhat unsettled. For example, the clitoris has external parts like the glands and hood, but it also has a vast internal structure. One would assume the clitoris definitely is a part of the vulva, but how often do we consider the clitoral legs called crura or the clitoral or vestibular bulbs a part of the vaginal structure? Rarely, if ever, is this conundrum discussed in pelvic anatomy literature. Research groups only provide contradictory literature, such as that some consider the clitoris to be a part of the vulva, and others showing the clitoris as an entirely separate structure from the vulva. Unsurprisingly, the meaning and context of the term vulva has evolved. And through that evolution, we have in some ways lost the ability to effectively communicate about anatomical structures that we have not distinctly named and identified. How can researchers even know they're talking about the same things if vulvar anatomical nomenclature is unclear? How does this translate to how the public understands their own body literacy? In order to untangle this history and understand the present-day use of the vulva as referring to external phenotypic endosex female genitalia, we have to start with the etymology. So where did the term vulva come from? Well, vulva comes directly from Latin, with only its spelling updated. The Latin spellings would have been things like vulua, volua, vulva, or ulua. And the Latin root is volu, that's V-O-L-U, also pronounced uolu or ulu, which means to roll. Vulva was considered synonymous with vulga or uolga, meaning a wrapper or a bag, and is also probably a corruption of the word bulga, again meaning bag. Okay, so upon first glance, that seems pretty weird because how would this connect to vulvas? They don't seem to roll and they aren't like a bag. So oddly enough, for over 1,000 years, vulva was used synonymously with references for the womb, including terms like uterus, hystera, and matrix. In its historic context, the reference to roll may be related to ovulatory or menstrual cycles, or perhaps to the cervix looking like a wheel when viewed from the exterior. The reference to bags makes more sense, knowing that the uterus is a cavity where a fetus develops. This would have been understood through both animal husbandry as well as midwifery. The Latin to English translation of vulva is womb. But womb also has a confusing etymology, with some sources pointing to it describing the uterus, while others described it as the combined structure of the uterus and the vagina. Uterus, too, has a history of making reference to a combined anatomical structure of the uterus and vagina, and sometimes the vulva, too. For example, os vulvae translates to the mouth of the womb, which describes the vaginal opening, even though it's referring to vulvae and womb as one in the same structure. Pudendum is another term used less often today, but it refers to the exterior genitalia of either binary sex. Sometimes it too was translated into the mouth of the neck of the womb. To make matters even more confusing, the vagina and the cervix were also sometimes referred to with this same phrase. To sum up all of this lovely word history, suffice it to say that the terms uterus and vulva were used interchangeably, and their enigmatic history makes science communication about these anatomical areas much more difficult today. The most glaringly obvious question about this history is how exactly did the vulva come to refer to the external anatomy in today's context, when historically it had pretty explicitly referred to the internal anatomical structures. Apparently, vulva had been used mostly to describe non-human wombs. In ancient Rome, vulva was not used to describe humans at all, but instead the womb of a sow or a female pig. Another piece of the puzzle, it seems, because the sow uterus looks a lot different from ours. It has a far more winding and coiling structure and appears to have a rolling type shape. This was well known since sow uterus was eaten as a delicacy. Now, this part may be disturbing for some listeners, so use the skip button for about 30 seconds if you don't want to hear about this particular delicacy. The recipe, called vulva ejectia, or miscarried womb, was made by forcing a heavily pregnant pig to miscarry through brute force on the stomach, and it was served a number of ways with the fetal pigs still inside, pickled, or stuffed with other meat like a haggis. So I'm sorry that we all just had to learn about that to understand vulvas because, you know, whoa. So it connects further to pigs though, because the Romans called the female external genitalia naturum, which was also known as porca, porcus, porcellus, or porcus, with porcus or chorios or chorion specifically referring to sacrificial matrimonial rites of the Etruscans, Italic tribes, and Greeks to signify fertility. So to think about this a bit further, this strengthens the connection between vulvas and ritualistic practices related to fertility and to virginity as likened to a sacrificial slaughtering of a pig that's done at a wedding ceremony. In fact, both of the terms, porcus and chorios, predate the use of the term vulva to refer to the female external genitalia. And porca was even sometimes used as a derogatory term for women themselves. Further connecting to the pigs is the term wallow. It's also relevant here because vulva and wallow share an etymological root, meaning to roll. And the Latin word volutrum also means a wallowing place for swine. And it's likely that the V in this word was switched for a W through contact with more northern languages. And so the term to wallow also signifies certain traits, such as immodesty and laziness or relaxedness. So the point to be taken from this is that this connection to pigs has more than one instance of metaphor for perversion, and that the taboo and degradation of female genitalia may go back to its very roots. It's not just pigs, though. Our genitalia has also been likened to other animals like birds and mollusks in particular. The labia majora are sometimes likened to concha. Pigs and mollusks also have an interesting connection. Cowrie shells belong to the family of sea snails and were once known by the terms porcelana, porcelanae, or porcelain due to their similar shape to the vulva. Sometimes cowrie shells are even called pig shells. And this shared etymology between vulva, porca, and porcelana, and the texture of a cowrie shell, if you've ever touched one, is where we derive the word porcelain from. One such mollusk of note here is a mollusk called Hystericoncha dioni. So notice the root, the Latin root here, hystera, meaning womb, and dioni, relating to the mother of Venus. Linnaeus, who was the first to describe the species and to name it, likened the Venus dioni mollusk to a human by using terminology we're familiar with, like vulva, anus, pubes, labia, mons veneris, and other terms. And this example speaks to zoomorphism, which is when a non-human animal trait is likened to a human, and also anthropomorphism of the mollusk itself by it being described with human terms. And as you've probably noted by now, this has made things very confusing for understanding our bodies. Vulva has also been likened to other anatomical places in the body. It has another alternative spelling, uvula, which is very close to the fleshy extension of the back of the soft palate that's hanging above your throat. That's called the uvula. And there are several instances of anatomical textbooks that have misprinted uvula for vulva. There's also another uvula, the uvula vesicae, which is a slight projection into the bladder cavity that is relatively close to the vulva. And vulva in other historical contexts may refer to vulva cerebri or cerebrum, aka a part of your brain. So there's one anatomical analogy that was made earlier in this episode. It's about the mouth of the womb. And if you think about that more, it refers to the digestive system. And terms like stomach also have roots referring to the mouth and the womb. Another easy connection is the word labia, which in many languages today still refers to the lips of the mouth, but is also the anatomical term for our two sets of fleshy folds on the vulva. Vagina may also be in reference to the verb to swallow, and some people may be familiar with the medieval myth of vagina dentata, which is a motif of a vulva that has physical teeth, which either symbolized the male fear of castration and the dangers of sex, or an alternative reading of it as symbols of fertility and preventing bad luck. The teeth again brings us back to the mouth. So this is another general problem that you'll see in anatomy, and it really shows up a lot in reproductive anatomy, which is naming parts after other body parts. The cervix would be yet another example where it refers to both the cervix of the uterus and the cervical spine of your neck. And so the cervix is sometimes called the neck of the uterus today. But as you can see, the problem with this, you know, as a whole. So what changed here? It's likely historical confusion regarding the term vulva to refer to the external genitalia changed with the use of the term quasi-valva, referring to a door or a valve starting in about the 7th century, where vulva becomes a description of the external genitalia instead of the uterus, as it had been for thousands of years before this. This traces back to the book Etymologiae by Saint Isidore of Seville, which holds the first recorded instance of quasi-valva and is thus the earliest deviation in the meaning of the term vulva. Etymologiae influenced Saint Rabanus Maurus, whose encyclopedia called De Rerum Naturis, which too defined the vulva as valva or a door of the belly. De Rerum Naturis was very popular at the time, and that caused it to be one of the earliest printed books ever. And this is where vulva gets its modern definition from, so it may have been related to a technological leap that made the word more accessible. And interestingly, the encyclopedia and the 1454 Gutenberg Bible are very close in age. And this Bible is very important as it was the earliest mass-produced book that was printed in movable metal type, and one of the most famous books of all time. It mentions vulua, but at the time probably still referring to the womb, several times, making Vulua one of the first mass-produced printed words in all of human history. So that's another fun fact about the vulva. Now, both, I think, you know, both of these are really interesting examples. And for those who are interested in old books, Ululae, and Ulula are only found in the Old Testament, whereas utero and ventris as terms are found more, in the New Testament, but found in both the Old and New Testament. So keep in mind that the original Hebrew and Greek versions at some point had to be translated into Latin, you know, that occurred later on, but many documentations of anatomy were still referred to in Greek and for a while did not use the Latin term vulva. So this was an ongoing process that took a lot of time, you know, to evolve. In the 16th century, Alessandro Benedetti frequently referred to the womb as the ulula, as did another contemporary named Jacopo Benegario da Carpi. He published the Carpi Commentaria, which was the earliest anatomical treatise that had figures illustrating the text. At this time is when he distinguished that the uterus references a human being, while the ulula, or the matrix, essentially the vulva, references animals, and that would have been consistent with the older terminology. His later work, though, went on to use matrix and vulva to refer to humans, and his work ended up having some of the earliest anatomical illustrations ever of the vulva. But remember that the vulva here still means the internal parts, so the image itself would have been a collective of the uterus and the vagina. In the 17th century, anatomists still weren't using the term vulva, but it started to reference female external genitalia when they did. So a popular midwifery book called The Woman's Book explicitly mentions that the womb passage, or the passage port, is named vulva. At almost the same time, an English translation also notes the name ulva, thereby moving that Latin term vulva into the English lexicon. So it had a lot to do with translations of these terms and, you know, the spread of anatomy information. By the 18th century, Latin was now being used less often in anatomical books, and as English started to predominate, the term vulva became more widely used. For example, Dr. Chamberlain's Midwife's Practice Book mentions the pudendum mulibre, the woman's modesty, of some it is called vulva, as it were valus, a valley, or valva, a floodgate, because it is divided into two parts by a cleft, which, like floodgates or leaf doors, are easily opened or shut as need is. Now, to bring us to presently relevant texts, in 1858, Henry Van Dyke Carter illustrated the first figure of the external female genitalia that is titled the vulva, and this was in Henry Gray's Anatomy. The book also referred to the vulva as the pudendum, or the external genitalia, and their most recent edition, which is the 42nd Gray's Anatomy, continues to do so. So vulva has remained since 1858 when the first edition came out. Now the vulva also has mythological origins. In St. Augustine of Hippo's De Civitate Dei, or City of God, where mention is made of the goddess Volutina, whose name comes from the same root as vulva, volo, to roll. Volutina was the goddess of the sheaths of corn. Uolua was also called the seed capsule of fruit, or the membrane which wraps up the fetus or fruit. Therefore, Volutina may connect with the vulva as a uterus or womb. And volu is also the root of the word volume. The reason being that ancient books were rolled out and not opened like the books of today. So that's the connection with the word to roll. So it's not out of the ordinary that seeds, or, you know, these other botanical terms have been used as metaphors for reproduction and life. And the plant genus Myrtus may also come from the word mirha, which is a virgin turned into a tree. And there are correlations with myrtle berries and the clitoris, as well as the word nymphae, which was used to describe the labia minora and is associated with water lilies. And sometimes the vulva was just called a garden in itself, through synonyms for vulva being words like hortus and hortulus cupidinus, or, you know, Cupid's little garden. And so there are numerous other references to the vulva as some sort of piece of fertile earth or farmland. And as we approach the present tense, the word vulva, meaning the external genitals, is all things considered a very recent historical development. The vulva has not stayed consistent as a term, and it's gone through many phases of evolution, with conflicting uses of the term very abundant, as you can see here. So descriptions of vulvas have been considered more of a space between parts or region rather than a part itself, such as the labia or the vaginal orifice. More modern literature also seems to reinforce difference between the anatomical structure of the clitoris and the vulva, such as phrasing the clitoris as being within the vulva. In fact, the Federative International Program for Anatomical Terminology does not consider the clitoris to be formally a part of the vulva. Confusingly, the frenulum and the clitoral hood are listed under the vulva, but not the clitoral subheadings. Even today, classifying a vulva proves very difficult, and other authors have suggested that the clitoris be reclassified as part of the vulva, with the vulva being referred to as the entire area from the mons pubis, basically like the top, to the anus, or all the way to the back. And others just consider it an area or a region of the body. Now, medical textbooks frequently refer to assessment of vaginal length in criteria for the vulva, thereby implying that the vagina is somehow considered a part of the vulva. So it's still very formally unclear whether the vagina is a part of the vulva, seeing it as an internal canal that seems like it would be outside of its definition, but it's all very subjective. So to summarize, still today, we have no real answers as to what constitutes a vulva. Even if we decide it refers to only the external parts, we still don't know what exactly it refers to in regards to what should be included, like the mons pubis, the labia, the clitoris, the vagina, and the perineum. There's also the question of the pudendum, which is a non-sex-specific term for the external genitalia. But in some ways, it's become erroneously synonymous with vulva. So some medical texts may incorrectly list them as such, list vulva and pudendum as synonyms. But this thereby disregards the male pudenda or intersex pudenda. Other terms like gonad or breasts are examples of non-sex-specific terms for areas of the body. It could refer to anyone. Furthermore, there are many other anatomical terms that refer to the pudendum amongst all sexes, for example, the pudendal nerves, the pudendal arteries and veins, etc. So in general, the literature tends to overemphasize female anatomy and underrepresent male anatomical terminology in this way. And that seems, you know, odd, right? For the most part, we would think, you know, males are overrepresented in medicine, and that is for sure true. However, the way that female bodies are overrepresented is usually in sex-specific images, and thereby this, you know, is a subjective choice that likens the female body with its sexual and reproductive functions. And so, I don't know if you've ever thought about this. I certainly hadn't before I delved into this research. There is still no formally recognized word that would be the male equivalent of the vulva. Never thought of that before, but yeah, there's no equivalent. And this is further complicated by the fact that males have vulvar anatomy, such as things like pubic hair. Men also have perineums, mons pubises, and external urethral meatuses. And we're just talking, you know, in cis terms here, but, you know, this applies to both endosex and intersex bodies, right? That we have this shared anatomy. A lot of times it's just arranged differently. So this is, you know, furthermore confusing because, yeah, what is a vulva? Is it sex specific or not? These are questions that are still very much unanswered. You know, there is no formal definition here that can fully satisfy us. There's a lot more to be understood. And to further illustrate that vulva and pudendum are not synonymous, we can look at the term eidos, the root of eidiou, which is a Greek synonym of the word pudendum. It's also the root of the term metiodioplasty, which is a surgical procedure used to form a neophallus as is provided through gender-affirming surgical techniques. Intersex presentations and trans bodies also have pudendums. However, the Federative International Program for Anatomical Terminology, the persons who set this terminology in a formal way, still only lists binary sex terms like vulva, female external genitalia, and male external genitalia, which disregards intersex phenotypes. So there's just another connection there between terms, which is really interesting. And as we've explored here, the vulva could mean just about anything, depending on who you ask and when you ask. It could mean a pig sow uterus. It could mean a pig wallow, a uterus, the combined uterus and cervix, the vagina, a female pudendum, the space between the labia, the mouth of the womb, vaginal orifice, and more. You know, it may have its roots in the objectification through botanical and zoomorphic means, really evolving from its early context, describing things like gardens and pigs with terms like porcus. And now we must ask ourselves if the practice of naming body parts in this way is appropriate for conducting scientific discourse. Many would argue that the history of these terms, you know, that they're dehumanizing. But interestingly, our hard line about this is quite subjective, as anatomical reference to something like breasts as jugs would be considered crude, while the uterus is known as a bottle, but that's considered completely acceptable term to use. So considering the perhaps pejorative context of the vulva dating back to these negative personality traits of a pig, we can question, will the term vulva evolve again? You know, will people learn this history now? And will they choose to, you know, stop using it? Similar to how at some point people used to refer to the external female genitalia as vaginas. And then maybe in the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years of my experience, people have slowly said, hey, no, it's not the vagina. The exterior part is called the vulva. The interior canal is called the vagina, you know? So these things are always evolving. And now that we look at what vulvas were in history and how this kind of switch happened, are we even using the appropriate terms, you know? I don't know the answer. I think this may have already happened with the word pudendum, actually, as the word pudendum traces back to the word ashamed, and it may have caused it to be kind of downgraded for use in official textbooks, even though other scholars have argued that pudendum more meant that it was a form of modesty or respect, not really shame. And so this brings in the question of modifying existing terms versus censoring those terms altogether in official literature. Do we understand the context, how the terms were used? There are numerous problems with anatomical names, I think, you know, whether they be named after people, named after plants, named after animals, or naming them after, you know, objects that they look like. I think it will make tracing back the terminology certainly more difficult if we choose to completely rename things and break with the history of names. So it's, you know, some really good questions to think about here. And I think it's a really good exercise sort of for everyone to think about the power that comes from being able to name your own body parts. First off, just from the perspective that some people are never taught the names of their body parts. And not being able to name your body parts or feeling shame about talking about them is part of how cycles of abuse perpetuate in many different contexts, such as, you know, medically or culturally. And then secondly, to be able to take power back from those who try to denigrate these parts by naming them a certain way. In my body literacy coloring book, for example, there's a whole page dedicated to renaming your anatomy, because through my studies, I found that several parts of the external genitalia are named after white male anatomists, and these were the people who usually had, you know, documented them in some way. So the exercise about renaming your anatomy is a chance to explore what's in a name and why it's important. Even still, you know, the glossary in the back of the anatomy book that I created names the vulva as the part of your genitals on the outside of the body, the labia, clitoris, vaginal opening, and the opening to the urethra. But now, after this episode, you know, I have reason to question my own definition of that and where that came from. So I don't know what the answer is for the term vulva. I'm sure I'll continue to use it in the modern sense that people, you know, use it today to describe the external, you know, female or intersex genitalia. But now I'll have to question, you know, if males have vulvas too, how should this be defined? You know, this episode definitely has me questioning all of this language and how it's applied to anatomy, as well as how people want their body parts to be referred to, right? Because that is always changing as well. And will that ever come to a place of agreement, or will it continue to be fluid in the way that the term vulva has been fluid? I think that in order for us to improve scientific communication, to create unity amongst fertility and midwifery professionals, and to conduct better research, we should take the time to explicitly define what the vulva is and how to deal with its history. So thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the history of words, and I hope you enjoyed the show overall. It's just a lot to really think about here with the regard to anatomy and vulva. I've always been really interested in anatomy since I started working on reproductive health. And the more I dive into it, the more I just keep learning, you know, the history gets deeper and deeper. So I'm curious, you know, what you as a listener think about this information and how you react to it, how you use terminology around your vulva, vagina, internal and external parts, and do you feel comfortable naming yourself and feel like you have a good handle on what is what. So thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate your listen on this episode. If you liked it, please share it with someone. You can find my show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And if you can take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review me, I would really appreciate that, as doing so helps more people find this show. This episode is brought to you by my fertility awareness education initiative. It's called #FamTaughtMe. You can also book a session with me by heading over to www.learnbodyliteracy.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at LearnBodyLit. This concludes episode 60 of the Someone Somewhere podcast. Good night.